All right, are we ready to rock?
Sure. I thought we were
here. I know. Yeah, no, listen, I know. We're losing all
the this. Shop talk. All right.
Welcome to another edition of the Beer Opinions Podcast. My name is Pat Berger of Kaiser Tiger and Patty Longs, and with me, as always, is Bruce White of the Chicagoland Beer Tours. Bruce, how are you doing?
Doing well, man. Nice, bright, sunny day. Weather update, and
it did snow this morning.
It did snow this morning. I know. Just doing well. How about you?
Fantastic. Yes. Yeah. No complaints. They did call off the Cubs game yesterday. Yeah. I think they're afraid of my Cardinals.
Yeah.
I think they are. I mean, that's my theory anyway.
Yeah. Use weather as an excuse. You know?
We pounded you guys pretty good on Tuesday. I just want to bring that up.
Yeah.
It's early in the season. Normally I wouldn't bring such a thing up. It's so early in the season. Means nothing. Means nothing. But, it's a fact. So we are on location today. We packed up the podcast equipment and drove out to beautiful Jefferson Park here in the Chicago Northwest Side, very close to where I live, and are visiting the Beverage Tasting Institute with its director, Gerald Okennard. Gerald, how are you, sir?
I am doing great, Pat and Bruce. Yeah. I'm glad you're here. I was going to say I'm glad to be here, but I'm always glad to be here. I'm at tastings.com. Slight correction, it's Beverage Testing Institute.
Oh,
everyone
sorry.
Gets that wrong because our website is tastings.com, and
yes.
Actually we rebranded the company as Tastings. We actually own the trademark for Tastings, which took a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to get, so I'm very proud of that.
Well, there's a lot of tasting and testing going on in this building.
Right.
I can attest to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for having us out. We've already gotten some tour, and I can't believe the amount of alcohol that you have on
That's
site
right.
here. It's
That's
just
right.
amazing. It's like a heaven, just, if you will.
Yeah, it's just comforting being near it all.
Yes.
You know, surrounded by it.
If the zombie apocalypse happens, this is where a good place to kind of take.
This would be a good
refuge.
Sanctuary. Yeah, I never thought of that. Yeah. I mean, yeah,
it would. Yeah, third floor. You know, you can. Are we in a undisclosed location?
We are
right
in an
now?
Undisclosed
yeah,
location.
We don't want anyone to.
It's a bunker, actually.
We're completely transparent and public. We're on Google Business and Maps and all that nonsense. So, yes, we repel visitors other ways, not by deception.
Well, it's a perfect segue into my first question here. Why don't you just kind of go over what does happen here at BTI, how it all works and the magic that goes
on. Sure. Yeah. So we've been doing this work since 1981. Actually, the company was founded in New York, in Ithaca. The owner at the time, Craig Goldwyn, he was interested in starting a wine competition. So he actually ran it out of his basement in Ithaca. And he worked with some food scientists at Cornell to develop the early methodology to make it real scientific, as opposed to just sort of I like this, I like that. And from those humble origins, he actually started the first international wine competition, which is called the World Wine Championships, that we still run today. So a good way to think of our business is that we run competitions here in Chicago using talented judges like yourself for our competitions, people that are in the trade and know products and no categories and no benchmarks are presented with new things all the time. So that's the core of our business, is running these competitions. And we do it for wine, beer, and spirits. And spirits-related things like mixers and RTDs and elixirs and all sorts of esoterica. But
Malternatives?
Malternatives, yes. We have the hard soda shootout coming out, actually. So watch for that, guys.
Yeah,
and be careful. I'll
keep an eye out for that email.
Yeah.
I'm going to
spam. You're going to take a pass.
Spam folder.
I'm going to ice you, man. Smirnoff ice you. I got to do that during the...
Actually, I would miss that. I would like to see that, actually. Yeah. I haven't done that in a while. It's been about 10 years since I've been iced. But that's what we call the competition part of the business. We're also, I mean, a good way to think about our company is, you know, we run a publication too, which is tastings.com. So we've got the competitions, and the results from the competitions go on tastings.com that we publish, and we produce this online buying guide for free for the public that's subsidized by the entry fees of the participants of the competition. So those kind of work hand in hand. And then we're a good way to think of us too as a marketing company. We produce content for, you know, suppliers and importers and things to use to market their products. We have POS and shelf talkers and awards and certificates and all that kind of stuff. So we're sort of a very specialized marketing company for the alcohol industry.
And you guys also, correct me if I'm wrong, but you will evaluate people's product as well and give them feedback,
yes.
Say if there's a new brewery popping up and
yep.
wants to, you know, have a panel of experts
yeah.
give their opinion on the product. You guys
mm-hmm.
do that as well, right?
Yeah, that's a part of our business. We have private consulting services too, where we do private tasting. So, you know, a lot of times breweries will just enter the competition, see how they do. But sometimes people will engage us privately and say, hey, this is coming to market. We're not sure about it. We're a new, you know, producer, and we have three different recipes. Could you help us pick and maybe refine the recipe? So we do that kind of work too, and it's become a big part of our business actually.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Can you give us a little background on how you got interested in this?
Oh, yeah. So like all good things, I sort of fell into it.
Yeah.
The last, I went to school for economics, got my economics degree from the University of Chicago. And the last course I took, the summer course I was required to take because I was, you know, I needed to take a summer course to finish. I won't go into any more detail than that. But it was a film class, and I just fell in love with film and directing. I've always watched films, but I learned about the mechanics of that. And so after school, I sort of ditched the economics and, you know, bank job sort of role that I was going to go into. That was the time of mergers and acquisitions, and investment banking was just taking off.
Greed is good.
Yeah, greed is good. Yeah, it was kind of that era. And I was like, I'm kind of more into the arts. I've always played in bands. I'm a musician. So I was like, you know, let me try this. You know, I'm young. Let me just try to see if I can become a director. And I actually found a brilliant school and teacher and went to directing school for 3 years, acting school for 3 years. And during that time, I needed a real flexible job. So I got into catering. And I turned out to be a better caterer than I was an actor. And so I started managing the catering company and being real good at that and having a staff of hundreds of people. And we do big parties all around the country and stuff. So that was fun. I actually miss those days, those kind of in the trenches days with the troops and stuff. Yeah. And from there, I met someone who was a real wine expert. And he was doing the wine programming for some of our clients like the Lyric Opera and a lot of the other institutions in town. And I got to learn about wine and spirits from him just doing these events, basically, and him telling me about this and that and the other thing. We would do really fancy parties in Lake Forest where people had these incredible cellars, and we'd go through and we taste things. So it was just a really cool experience, and I started getting into wine, and I started tasting. He actually left the catering company, went to work here. And when
okay.
he came to work here as the tasting director in the early 90s, you know, he invited me once in a while to come taste and sit on the panels and stuff. And so I learned more and more and more. And then, the course of life, my wife and I decided to have a kid. She was the sous chef at this catering company. And she decided, well, I don't think I can work 80 hours a week and nights and weekends anymore with an infant. So we were like, okay, we need to figure this out. So we started to transition out of catering. And as it turned out, right after her maternity leave was about to end, I got a call from this guy that we had worked with that was working here. He said, hey, there's some investors that bought into the company. They want to start a wine magazine, and we're hiring lots of people. Do you know anyone who could be like our office manager and corraler of judges and stuff? And I said, I got the perfect person for you. And you know her, and you love her, and she's great. And so Deb came to work here actually before I did, right after our son was born. And then I came about a year and a half later. I worked here part-time for a while. I tried a couple different things. I managed a private club downtown. I tried to sell wine, but nothing was really a fit. And so I started to work here part-time on the databases. They were doing a big database project. They were trying to integrate drinks.com was trying to be the first online liquor store for the country, and it was a huge project. And
mm-hmm.
BTI was working with the investors in that to make it happen. And I just really liked the work. I liked the data, I liked the wine, I liked the kind of excitement, the different, you know, aspects of the job, and I just never left.
Well, good. You know, let's get into a little bit about the panels because, you know, full disclosure, I am a beer panelist here. I was here last week.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Tasting beer. You won't believe this, Bruce, but there were some Northeast IPAs. Yeah.
And he was fair and impartial.
I tried to be very fair.
I'm glad that this happened. This makes me, my soul ring, you know, sing a bit. So that's good. You're coming around slowly but surely.
It's the only way we can get Pat to do them is if we put him in front of him blind.
That's right.
Never saw him coming.
What is this orange juice? Get it out of here.
I tried to judge them on the merits of the category, which is what we do here, which is another reason I really like judging here. I mean, let's get into the judging here because,
sure,
as you know, I'm a BJCP judge. I've done a lot of homebrew competitions. I've done I've done the national homebrew competition. I've judged the World Beer Cup and a couple of other things. This is my favorite venue to judge in, and you know, it's a lot of it has to do with the way you guys set it up. So why don't you kind of explain how
sure,
it's done?
Yeah. So, you know, we have our own proprietary methodology and software that we've developed over the years. So basically it comes down to a few ideas that that are core. The first one is that we're not judging, you know, what you like. You know,
right,
you don't like Northeastern IPAs, but you're able to kind of put your feelings about those things at the door and come in as a buyer and say, objectively speaking, this is a high quality product.
Yeah.
I could, or not, you know, and this meets the style criteria that I would look for in a product if I were to bring it on as a buyer. So that's first and foremost that kind of people leave their baggage at the door and are judging things as objectively as you can for a subjective thing as taste, right?
Right.
The other idea too is that we're judging to kind of this ideal. Like, you're not saying in a flight of, you know, four or five lagers, this is the better than this one, better than this one. We don't ask that question. We say, how does this particular one compare to the best Pilsner you've ever had? And you make that as the basis of your comparison. And you say, okay, on the basis of that, I think it's a commercially sound product, or I think it's better than that, or I think it's worse than that. But that other idea of commercially sound, you know, Budweiser is a very commercially sound product. It doesn't get, you know, high scores or anything from anybody, but that's like a benchmark for something that below that quality level, you probably wouldn't serve it, right? It had to have some sort of flaw or some sort of condition issue that would say, I can't serve that. But, and then you go from that baseline of, you know, commercially valid and reasonable to like good, great, and glorious, right? From there. And from there, it's really, we're relying on the judges to have those kind of benchmarks in their mind for the categories, that kind of objectivity. And there's also a bit of the fun of discovery because, as you know, from the panel process, we put in our scoring, which is a very simple scale. And that's another thing with the methodology. It's not something that you have to worry about. Like, I've got 3 points for aroma and 4 points for head retention.
Right.
And you're not messing around with that stuff. You're looking at the whole product in its totality and you're saying, this is a commercially sound thing, or this is very good, or this is excellent in its totality, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that we can get rid of all the little pointillistic stuff and we can talk about the flavors and we can talk about the experience of the beer and the application and, like, was there a customer for this beer? We focus on that. And when that's after we do our quick scoring and evaluation, we talk about it and we learn from each other. And that's really the other part of the process of tasting here is everyone gets better by just doing it, by exercising those muscles, if you will. You know, one of our panelists calls it mental yoga, and I really agree with that because you're exercising your imagination, your sense memory, your ability to describe things, and it's really hard to do. And so we don't ask our judges to do it a lot. we limit how many products they taste in a day. We don't say, hey, you're going to taste 50 beers today. I'm like, oh my God, I couldn't even imagine it doing 50 beers the way we do it.
Right.
Because we're really doing like mini reviews of these beers. Right?
Right. Yeah.
And so by limiting the number of samples, and like for beer, it's no more than 25. Same for wine. For spirits, no more than 18. We're able to really focus on the products because these are people that have sent things to us. And this is their livelihood. We're not just going to be dismissive and say this sucks or this and that. We're going to give them some real professional feedback like, yeah, you know, even if there's a problem here, here's the technical faults with this so that you can improve your product. We're not here just to slap you down and say you suck.
Right.
So that's the way we approach it from that perspective, we tell people their products stink sometimes. We have the luxury of doing that because we have thousands of customers all around the world. So like other marketing firms, we don't have two or three clients that, you know, we have to please all the time. We can be very brutally honest with them and really work with them to help them make their products as good as they can be. Now, sometimes people listen to that. Sometimes they don't. But it's there for them to take.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm kind of curious on focusing in on the beer component a bit because, you know, when I first kind of entered buying alcohol as a consumer, I was very used to ratings when it came to wine. I want to say like wine was kind of the first thing where I noticed wines in a lot of ways have been advertised with ratings attached for a long period of time. Spirits maybe also as well. And then beer, you know, one thing, the craft trend in certain parts of the country wasn't really around. Mm-hmm. So there really wasn't anything to rate, even if you wanted to. And it was kind of a... I don't think a lot of people think of beer or used to think of beer in that way.
Right.
So, you know, I guess, have you kind of noticed that? What percentage has the beer kind of rating gone up in relative or from your perspective, is it pretty similar?
Well, our perspective is kind of unique because we invented it. There was no one rating beer before us numerically like we do. We actually borrowed everything, spirits and beer ratings, from our wine methodology that we'd been doing a decade prior. We started doing beer in 94. And so we started that relationship with All About Beer magazine at that time. And that was the first time you had, you know, publication with numbers associated beer, because we just took the methodology from our wine and kind of adapted it a little bit with styles and stuff.
Sure.
So we've seen that arc. And, you know, I think it's a battle between points and medals, right? I mean, that's really the two models for rating beers these days. And I think, you know, medals are still on top. We still have customers that come to us because our points convert to medals, and they want that gold medal or that silver medal or that bronze medal as well as the points. So we offer both. but I think from my experience, it's maybe like 60-40 medals to points if I had to break the market as far as what I see people doing and using out there. But I think points are a really powerful tool. I've talked to lots of brewers that are like, yeah, I kind of like that idea because it just sort of summarizes it really crisply, and they can see the difference. They know that for us, a gold medal is between 90 and 95 points. So that's kind of a big range. Like the guy who got 95, he can say, okay, that makes sense that this other beer that's my competitor is here or there, the other thing. And it's a little bit more discreet. You know.
And they can kind of pinpoint a little bit more with a little more specificity.
Yes.
I didn't say that word
specificity.
Right.
Specificity?
I don't think that's a word.
Yeah, they can. And they that gives them some places to shoot for, right?
Yeah.
You know, even within the gold medal band, as we call it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I kind of poked around a little bit beforehand and on the website, great website, so consumers can go. And what's the exact, is it tastings.com?
It is.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So tastings.com, you can check it out. But I noticed, I believe the points are, I just want to kind of go through this.
Sure.
It,
I can recite them from memory
if you
like.
Yeah, you probably can do this better than I can.
Gerald did write it.
Yeah. But it's like an 80 to 100 point scale, right?
It is. So the reason of that, and that's in our methodology, is like we're not here to beat people up. You know, if it's below 80, we call it 79 NR, not recommended. You know, the difference between a 40, a 50, and a 60, who cares? No one's going to drink any of that or ever order it. That's something we learned from wine. A lot of the wine critics go down to 50 or 60 or whatever, but no one's buying those wines. No one's interested in that. So we determined that 80 to 100 is kind of where things fall. And we do have things that are not recommended. We had some actually when we tasted with Pat. In the case of beer, it's usually... You know, it's sometimes it's a more of a production fault versus like stylistically they screwed up. But, you know, that's the range. And we found that that's kind of the range where consumers are interested in purchasing products. So that's why we just do everything between that range.
Sure.
Gerald, what is your opinion on, you know, now that beer rating is, it's massive now, right? Mm-hmm. It's a big business and there's lots of apps and, you know, the most famous probably being Untappd.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I consider Untappd kind of like the Yelp of beer, right?
Sure.
So you've got a lot of, you know, just average consumers on the street rating these products. And they're very good at getting their SEO in order. And when you Google a beer, that untapped rating sometimes is the first or second thing to pop up.
Sure.
And, you know, it's definitely, I think, and, you know, all these breweries will tell you, it makes a difference when it comes to sales. Mm-hmm. If you can get a nice rating on untapped, you are ahead of the game, right? People are going to go after that beer. What is your opinion on all that? Because, you know, I think a lot of brewers are getting frustrated with sort of the amateur palate telling them what's good. And, like, you know, they're not seeing it as helpful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when somebody who doesn't necessarily know what they're talking about is giving them a one star on Untappd and saying, you know, this beer's gross and nothing else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Have you guys tried to be the alternative to that? Is there a way to combat that sort of?
Yeah, we kind of are the natural arts alternative to it, because we've been doing this the way we've been doing it with professional judges for so long. I mean, we're kind of analogous to, you know, the Great American Beer Festival or the World Beer Cup in terms of methodology of using at least people that are brewers or people in the trade, mm-hmm. versus consumers. Yeah, it's a fine line, because I'm not, you know, I don't really use any of those things. I'm too busy with what I have going on, but I do study the market, because we have to look at it from the perspective of, like, what's a beneficial service to our customer. And we did entertain the idea of having a crowdsource kind of component when we relaunched the site a couple of years. I decided to put it on the back burner, just because I think the value of our service is that you are getting that professional feedback. You are getting something from buyers who would conceivably buy this product. And I think that has value to the people that enter our reviews. So I don't pay a lot of attention to it. I know it's out there. It's funny. I do licensing deals with different retailers, and one of them was Mariano's. And they were using our wine and spirits ratings for their shelf talkers, but they were using Rate Beer for the beer shelf talkers. And I was like, you know, we do beer too. And the ratings were that they picked out, at least, were always 98, 99.
Right.
And at that point I looked at it and I started to delve into it. I saw what I considered to be some great inflation on the scales based on styles and so forth. But, I didn't look much further than that particular project. I'd have to say that, you know, I think we're a good alternative to that. I'm actively trying to promote the fact that we exist to consumers, and I think that's important.
I think that is important. You know, they also have the advantage of, you know, there's almost not a product that isn't reviewed by these sites.
Right.
Whereas you guys, you know.
It's impossible to taste all the beers produced in the world. We couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could, you know. You could certainly give it a go.
We could give it a really good go, and I've been thinking about ways to do that.
I've been trying. But and people have to send you their beer. You're not out there, you know, at the bars putting ratings on your website. Mm-hmm. People have to send it to you. They have to,
That's right, and it's our job to market our services and get people to send it in. And, you know, frankly speaking, beer is the third most popular category of things that we review here in terms of volume of things that we do. I'm always looking to grow the beer program, because I love beer, and I think it's fascinating to the innovation that's going on in beer. I think it's probably the most innovative category of beverage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's growing so fast, it's kind of a double-edged sword, because a lot of these people can't even keep it in stock. So what do they need marketing help for? We had to say adios to Three Floyds, which was a great customer early on, because they didn't need our marketing help anymore. They didn't need any more ratings. They had what they needed, you know, years ago.
I'm kind of interested in, I think it's an interesting distinction, the consumer driven ratings versus professionals, because, like, and I'm happy to chat a little bit about Cicerone, if hopefully.
I'd love to.
Yeah, and because that's another kind of tasting in a hopefully a different kind of market,
mm-hmm.
not a direct competitor, but I took a class there, and an off flavors class that was one of their kind of 12 step one, and it's insane. The number of flavors that I could not pick up, and I consider myself an educated amateur. Mm-hmm. Versus what the brewers who were in the class could pick up every single off flavor in the first second of even coming remotely close to their nose. Mm-hmm. So there is an absolute talent in kind of tasting beer and I'm sure tasting wine and spirits as well, mm-hmm. that the average consumer just will not have. And I would put myself in the average consumer category. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to be pretentious about it. So no. I think it's kind of interesting. And I wonder, you know, how do you kind of know what panelists to invite and how do you kind of talk about tasting from a professional level?
Sure. So we're always trying to find talented people like you speak, like you're talking about. And a lot of it comes from referrals. Like I think Chad, who just recently came on board on sales and marketing with us before he was involved in production, he recommended that Pat came on board years ago.
Yeah.
And a few other talented people. So it's always
you
the
don't
recommendations.
Always hit the right ones then.
No, sometimes you get incredibly lucky.
Yeah, I've stuck around. Some of them aren't invited back.
This is true. So there is a process. What we do is we audit our panelists. We have them come in and their scores don't count for a while until they get used to our methodology, to the entire idea of how we're approaching these things, until they listen to some of the other panelists who really know what they're doing. And then their scores will count and they'll become a judge after, you know, 3 or 4 sessions. So that's built into our process. And as far as finding those people, it's always just, you know, recommendations, going to the best venues, looking at the people that have great programs and have great lists, are probably doing something right and are probably aware of good products out in the market. And those people tend to be good, you know, tasters. You know, the successful people out there, basically.
Yeah, because, you know, in my opinion, there are people with superhuman palates. There are.
Mm-hmm. Super tasters.
You know, yeah, I think Gerald's one of them, quite frankly. You know, you pull stuff out of there that, sometimes I can get it after you say it, but a lot of times, you know, I'm still not getting it. I think I have a decent palate. My sister, who is a wine person, she has a super palate. She has a superhuman palate, you know, cool. And she gets tastes that I don't get. I think I've read that women actually have better palates than men, and I believe that. I think everyone can taste things, and unless you have, you know, some sort of damage to your taste buds or something, but your average person can taste things. A lot of it comes from experience and from sitting down with someone who knows what they're talking about, mm-hmm. And it all starts to click, mm-hmm. you know, for me anyway, mm-hmm. and tapping into those taste memories.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a big thing for me when I'm trying to, because there's sometimes you can taste something, but you don't know how to explain it to the other panelists, right. Or, you know, how to put it down on paper. And the only way to do that is to compare it to something that you've had before. And once you can tap into those memories, I think you become a much more experienced, taster.
It builds. You build up your library of references and ideas. And another component to it is training. I mean, early on, we had Siebel, Lynn from Siebel, come in here and do the off flavors and the faults training extensively. I mean, I brought the whole beer panel at the time. It was, I think, 12 people. And that kind of exercise is invaluable, so that you're giving accurate things to brewers, because brewers are very fastidious people. I remember experience I had early on where we had a very, very super taster kind of person, and he was saying that almost everything he tasted had DMS in it. And maybe to him it did. It had maybe low levels no one else could taste. But at one point he was moderating a panel, and he was doing the composition of the tasting notes, and it was going out to these brewers, and the brewers were calling me up because I was the salesperson at the time, and they were saying, no, excuse me, I can show you my logs from the last 3 months. There is no DMS in my beer. And so I was like, oh, okay, we better really make sure we know what we're talking about, because you can't just throw a vat of cream spinach and cooked corn at this guy and say, hey, you got DMS, when they know their stuff.
Right. You know, and that's another thing is, like you were talking about those off flavor kits, which I can't recommend enough.
Yeah.
Because you can be told, you know, that DMS tastes like cooked vegetables, but it might not to you.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's palate is a little bit different. And, people talk about diacetyl, it tastes like butterscotch. It doesn't to me.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it tastes like diacetyl, but mm-hmm. There's a difference between butterscotch to me. I mean, to me, it's more of a microwave popcorn thing.
Mm-hmm. Popcorn, yeah.
You know, but it's different to everyone. And when people kept saying butterscotch at the beginning, you know, when I was first, you know, learning to judge and stuff, I was giving, I was thinking a lot of beers that were really just malty.
Were
full of diacetyl because you know malt gives off butterscotch flavors to me.
Caramelized,
you know, especially
malts.
Caramel malt. Caramel malt to me is a big butterscotch flavor. So once you get that concentrated diacetyl spiked into a beer, it's a unpleasant experience to go through the off flavor kit. But I can't recommend it enough. Then you decide what diacetyl tastes right. like.
And you have your memory of it.
Yes.
Well, and the problem is too, like I think of butterscotch and I think of fond memories. Like I think of like grandparents and like butterscotch cookies.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, how could a beer that has that be bad? You know, almost in a weird way, but it makes it terrible if in the right amount in the situation. So I totally agree. And the off color classes are remarkable in that.
And there's some there are some other things too that we do training wise too, as far as benchmarks. I was actually training my replacement, Laura. Speaking of Super Taster, she's amazing, and you know, but her area of expertise is wine and spirits. So I'm, you know, buying benchmarks from a mutual friend of ours in their store and bringing them in and saying, okay, let's taste it through these. These are what are considered to be the benchmarks. Do we feel that way? You know, are there new benchmarks out there? And so it's a collaborative thing where you're taking in information from the panelists, from other professionals, and saying, what's really happening out in the beer world? Is are these things being consistently made? You know, the things that you thought benchmarks, not benchmarks anymore. And it's really you have to prepare for a panel and really have those kind of ideas in your head, because even the things that you thought were great might not be great anymore.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. I love tasting with wine experts because to me they are they're just better than us beer judges because they're tasting fruit juice, you know?
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's one ingredient in wine,
right.
You know, and beer has such a myriad amount of flavors. It's easier to taste than wine is, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're pulling all of this stuff out of something that is, you know, essentially just grape juice, you know, fermented grape juice. And it's always an eye opener. And I've had the chance here to judge with some somms who, honestly don't know that much about beer, but to listen to them describe these beers is eye opening and a learning experience,
right,
you know?
Right.
Right. And I wonder if also part of that is just that I think the wine industry just has a much longer tradition of that as well.
It's certainly.
You know, like in terms of,
that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And that was kind of our thing because we started the company in 81. So by 94, we'd had over a decade of experience doing that. We were like, let's take our time. So it was like a 3-year project to like figure out how to do beer and make sense of it. And I think, you know, early on we made a couple errors, but since then we've kind of adapted. And I think what we do is solid. I mean, it's hard again because it is subjective. And so you have a range of people that are coming in. And that's the good part, is that you have not just me saying this is such and such, but you have Pat and you have other talented judges that are professionals that have strong opinions and that have, you know, great experiences, and they're bringing them to bear. And so the final score that goes out is a composite of that, as is the tasting note. So it's really a collaborative process.
Yeah.
That's cool. Totally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The other aspect that I really find intriguing every time I come in here, and to me, it's what keeps bringing me back, is the blind judging.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell our listeners enough how important it is to blind judge. And it's very hard to do at home because, you know, you would have to set up a steward who, you know, and in fact, it's even best if you don't, you know, you'll ruin it too, even if you know what the 10 beers are beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Because should be double blind. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do here. Like we have no idea what's coming in.
Mm-mm.
And beer is so heavily marketed. It's such a heavily marketed product that the second you take a look at that bottle, you're already forming opinions.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, they don't spend like $100 million or billions of dollars on marketing for without a good reason to do so, right?
Yeah. There's so a very true. Good reason. Yeah. And, you know, as a beer buyer, you know, I taste 30 or 40 beers a week, but I'm always presented with the beer. And and as a buyer, you need to, because, you know, you're not necessarily just, you know, buying whatever you think scores the highest. You're also buying what you think is going to sell.
It's true.
And
you're buying a brand.
You're buying a brand, yes. Mm-hmm. And you need to know that, like, hey, this beer tastes really, really great, but it's, you know, Budweiser's Pale Ale, and it's probably not going to move at Kaiser.
Not
you
with
know?
Your clientele, yeah.
I mean, we actually, they did make a Budweiser Pale Ale.
I remember that.
It was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
And I stupidly bought a keg. It did not move. But it was a long time ago.
I do remember
so,
that beer.
So those things do matter, but it will change your perspective on breweries. It happens to me every time I'm in here, a brewery that I don't think that much of blows me away. It happened mm-hmm. last week again. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think my favorite beer of that bunch came from Rogue, mm-hmm. who I don't, you know, I like Rogue. Right. I don't dislike them or, you know, anything like that. Mm-hmm. But there's certainly when I, you know, get into a conversation of my 10 favorite breweries in the world, they don't come up, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and there they are presenting me with, you know, one of the best black IPAs I'd ever had.
Yeah, me too. I agree. It's kind of, there's so much going on. There's so much newness. There's the, you know, the symphony of new that you get allured to, but there's also all this great stuff that you really can't forget about that too. You have to really drink a lot of beer, taste a lot of beer to stay connected to both ends of that spectrum, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, if you're listening now and you're able to pull something like that off at home, do it because it'll blow your mind. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. I've had a love hate relationship with Sam Adams, but I can tell you right now, we score them incredibly high here.
Yeah,
blind tasting Sam Adams. I mean, you put one in front of me when I'm playing my beer buyer role, and I go, oh, this isn't gonna sell. You know, mm-hmm. and I'm already have a
negative. You want to not like it, right? Like,
well, I want to have an excuse to tell the guy, no, I'm not going to buy it. Mm-hmm. You know, I do
right,
because
sure.
I know it's not going to move. Mm-hmm. Here, all of those beers do very well. They because they are really good. They make
well
incredible
made.
Beer.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
You know, so I just think it's a invaluable tool to open your eyes every once in a while.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally. Yeah.
Have you noticed with kind of the explosion of growth in craft beer, has the demand for your services, are you getting, you know,
it's not proportional, which irritates me. Like, because a lot of the growth is happening so fast, as we said before, that, you know, they can't keep up with the demand. So they don't really need marketing. They're trying to fill orders and make people happy with keeping the spigot on. So I understand that, but it's nice to see a range of new customers and new brands, and we do see that.
Yeah, and they will come. It's just a matter of time, I think. Yeah,
you know, as the market changes and maybe contracts and people are more competitive, they'll start looking for different points of differentiation. So we'll see some of that too. I mean, we've been doing it a long time. We've seen the cycles.
Sure.
Long time. I judged with you guys the first time. It must have been 1999.
Uh-huh.
And you were in a little tiny office in the West Loop.
Yes.
Or in the Greek town sort of area.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, all I remember is there were boxes of booze just wall to ceiling.
Yeah, sure.
And it was only like three little rooms. And I just got my BJCP.
Uh-huh.
And Greg Brown, who's been on the podcast, former
guest. Yeah, Greg Finn, shout out.
Yeah, you invited him to come down, and he was like, oh, can I bring this kid who works with me? He's, you know, just got his BJCP. And
yeah.
So I got to go down, and that might have been my first judging ever.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, that was at our old location.
Old location.
On Peoria,
yeah.
That was actually when I was working part-time, so yeah, I wasn't officially on the team yet in 99.
Al Dickey was still he was on the panel.
He
I think it was me, him, and Greg.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then I didn't come back again until 2007 or something when Chad
I didn't
came
realize
out
he'd been there earlier. That's
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
they
cool.
probably didn't count my scores. I was new.
Who's this kid?
Yeah.
That's cool. Thanks for sharing that. I had no idea.
Yeah. What else you got, Bruce? I know you're always full of questions.
Yeah, well, you know, I just I guess in terms of kind of scoping out maybe a little away from beer and just talking generally, you know, any kind of stories that funny stories you want to share about, you know, any kind of interesting kind of behind the scenes funny stories or anything?
Well, I can tell you about the differences between beer judges and wine judges and spirits judges from my perspective, which is interesting for people.
Yeah, I want to hear that.
Yeah, well, there's an old saying that beer judges don't spit. So that's the first thing you have to get used
That
to.
Is true.
And I've had conversation with beer tasters and professionals for years. It started like when I first did a press junket. They actually, Anheuser-Busch sent us to their malt stirring house, and I was on the bus with all these other people, and we were talking about how we taste beer, and I was like, yeah, I do this and then the other thing, and said, but how do you do that many beers and not be drunk? Because, you know, I was just telling him about my morning from 9 to 11, and then I got a marketing job and taking care of customers and all this, and like, well, I spit. And so, you spit? But how can you taste the beer if you spit? And I'm like, well, I bring it as far back as I can in my throat before I swallow, and then I spit. It kind of doesn't look very pretty, but you get the retronasal, and they were like, oh, really? And then we started practicing on the bus, and you're like, oh, okay. So I was like, good, I'm not crazy. This can be done. But it's just interesting. And then you go to a wine, and then you go in to, you know, to a wine panel, and they're all spitting like crazy, and they're swishing their mouth out, and they're going through like a dozen crackers and stuff like that. So in the spirits judges, it's 50-50. So I think they've been infiltrated by wine and by beer. So some of them spit, some of them don't. For our standpoint, it's like we have to just because.
Yeah, just the volume.
The volume of what we're doing here. And then, you know, basically afternoon is business time. And so we have to be completely alert for that.
Yes, I don't spit.
I'm not trying to spit shame you.
No, no. I'm lucky enough nowadays that when you invite me out here, I take the day off.
Oh, and, good.
You know, I go home and maybe take a nap. And
I always wondered about you.
Yeah, but but back in the day, back in the early days of Patty Long's, we always tasted on Wednesday.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
Wednesday was my order day.
Right.
So I would come in here.
Where's that Sam Adams? Take, take a case of that.
I would taste 24 beers and then go in and do inventory.
Yeah,
and basically stare at a wall of beer and miscount. And then I'd go upstairs and taste another 20 beers with my reps.
Oh, wow.
And but you know, I'm old now. I can't do any of that.
It's tough to do.
Yes. I do have a superhuman ability to consume beer, but
I noticed that.
But like, I can't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. It catches up to us all.
It catches
up to us all.
There's only so much like caffeine and green tea or whatever. I do green tea, and there's a certain point it doesn't work anymore.
I remember complaining to you about I won't say who the contest was, but I went to this beer contest and it was 117 beers they made me taste.
Holy. I remember that. And in an afternoon, right? It was like
it was like 8 hours. Yeah,
8 hour day. Okay.
It was 8 hours. And Mike Roper was there, and he left about halfway through.
Oh, he's a smart man. He's
well, I remember when he left, I was like, pussy, you know, can't believe he left. And then like an hour later, I'm like, he's the smartest man I know.
It's like doing.
Why didn't I leave when Roper left?
It's like doing a high ABV version of the Century Club when you're in college, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, holy smokes.
Oh, it was dumb. And the last flight they brought out was 27 IPAs. Oh, I was like, I don't know what to do.
What am I supposed to do with these things?
Right.
They look nice.
But it was like the Homer Simpson thing when he gets kicked out of the all-you-can-eat buffet and then goes fishing. Because where did I go after that contest? The map room.
The map room?
Yeah.
Sitting at the map room with a beer, bitching about how I just drank all this beer.
Believe they made me drink all this beer?
Yeah, I can't believe that, Pat. You want another beer?
Yeah, I'll have another beer.
It's like you might as well drive right into it, you know, at that point. You might as well just steer into it. There's no,
We go contrarian here. So, like, if we're tasting beer, like, the last thing at the... And go home as I want a wine or I want a cocktail. Uh-huh. If it's a spirit, it's a beer. And ping pong between. You always have to have something, right? To get rid of the taste in your mouth of whatever you
had
that
right.
day.
That's right. Just to be civil.
Just to be civil, yeah.
What are you drinking lately, Jerome?
Well, what did I have last night? Oh, Pilsner Urquell in a can, our favorite, talking about little trace amounts of diacetyl.
Yeah.
We had that whole riff last time. So I drink a lot of white wine, actually. I'm more of a white wine drinker than a red wine drinker. My wife loves Chardonnay, so I usually do something a little bit more bright and acidic, like a Sauvignon Blanc or something like that. I do a lot of rosé, white wine, Pinot and stuff at home. Beer-wise, when I get done here, like I was saying, I need some scrubbing bubbles, so I usually go for something classic like a Pilsner, but usually a hoppier one or an IPA.
Yeah.
Session IPA. I just finished that mixed case of Sierra Nevada fresh hop IPAs.
Oh, and, nice.
I'm always looking for another kind of hoppy beer just to kind of just scrape everything away.
Yeah.
I'm very functional with my beers.
There's a method to the madness.
There's a method to the madness. And spirit wise, it's whiskey, it's bourbon, it's scotch for the most part, brown spirits.
I have a little side question that. Just this kind of, I think it's interesting to talk since you're involved in wine as well. There was a discussion on Twitter, beer Twitter, somebody pointed out that she was noticing that the labels on beer cans, the name of the beer was starting to become really pronounced, and the brewery was starting to become smaller.
Mm.
And so the thing that came to my mind, which big brewers apparently have feared for a long time, is kind of the, quote, winification of beer. In other words, that beer might be started to be purchased instead of by brewery, by style. And a lot of times that's how it's sorted. So I'm wondering if you've kind of had any thoughts about this or noticed any trends or anything? I know it's a kind of an obtuse question.
We do a packaging competition. Actually, some of the winners, except for those little guys on top, are some of the winners from the last couple of years. So we see those kind of trends a lot. As far as style taking over, I mean, what is the classic one? Lagunitas IPA, I suppose, you know, for like, I'm buying an IPA. That thing says IPA in real big letters. That's what I want.
Yeah.
And there's a certain pull through in the market for that. So people gravitate, like you said, towards that kind of concept. I don't think beer is because it has this kind of wacky creativity in the craft scene. I think it's more about the imagery and the art. I mean, I'm thinking of pipeworks and things like that. That's what people seem to gravitate towards. But I mean, it's open for me. I mean, we see smaller branding in wine. I agree with that. I think these kind of bespoke proprietary names and things are getting bigger in font sizes. I would totally agree with that in wine. And now that you mention, I'd say it's probably the same in beer too, but as far as like crazy imagery and then a name versus like, what brewery is this? You got to turn around to the side. I do that all the time in beer. Like, who made this thing?
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
It's interesting that they're doing that. I personally haven't noticed, because people really do buy breweries. They don't necessarily buy beers, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we talk about Three Floyds a lot, but, you know, when I throw a Three Floyds on tap, that beer sells. It doesn't matter what the style is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Alpha King's my number one beer, but if I switched it to one of their other core brands, that would be my number one beer, you know, because people buy Three Floyds. So, if they're, you know, I guess maybe some of these smaller breweries who don't have a name out there are kind of like, maybe I can, I don't know, maybe they're just trying to punch up their name, the beer name over the brewery name. I don't know. That's a good question.
And I wonder if it's more of a, you'd probably see less of it. It'd probably be much more in like a package, like when you're buying it at the grocery store or at a beer store or something like that.
I mean, people do bring us packaged beer to taste, but you're right. I don't necessarily stare at that label very often, you know, very much.
Yeah. And their consumers at Kaiser or Patty Long's, they're not going to be buying it because they're not going to see
it. Correct. They're buying it off of a menu.
Yeah. So, yep.
You know, not like a retail situation where it's a shelf competition.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In wine, you're right. They do normally organize the wine store by style, not by winery, and then the beer section will all be by brewery.
Yep.
That's not changing, is it?
I don't think it has yet. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if it will at some point. I wouldn't. To be honest, it wouldn't surprise me.
I mean, I am seeing beer menus at some of the fancier beer bars. I know the Publican does this where it's really, they're highlighting the style. You know, they take a very much of a
progressive
wine approach.
It's a progressive menu.
Yeah, it's a wine approach to the menu. Mm-hmm. And at first that bothered me. And now, you know, just because I'm an asshole.
Any chance?
Yeah.
Why do I have to sort through all these styles?
I'm a curmudgeon. But it doesn't bother me anymore. In fact, I tend to look for beers by style now when I'm at a restaurant or something, mm-hmm. you know, because I have something in mind that for my meal.
Yeah.
So it makes sense to me.
Well, especially with the lengthy beer list, you know, you want to. You know, I don't want to sort through every single one of these.
Yeah, really, I know I want a lager, or I know I want an IPA, and mm-hmm. instead of going through every beer they have, know, I guess it would be. Maybe I should do that at my restaurants. Fuck that. Crisp, a lot of work.
Crisp and light, hoppy and strong. I guess malty and chewy.
No, I want you all to sift through every beer. Not making it easy on anyone.
Exactly.
Oh, but that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
And then I guess another offside question, and this is, I think, applicable to both of you. For those of us at home who maybe aren't as experienced in kind of tasting beer, are there any, and you kind of already, kind of, Pat, you already gave kind of that being able to use your memories to kind of try to locate those flavors. What other kind of tips can you give people in terms of if they want to kind of push their palates a bit and understand really what they're tasting?
Mm, sure. Yeah. You want to take that, Joe?
Sure. There's like a whole regimen. I think the most important thing is to taste things kind of with an open mind. To like the first step in our process is kind of leave your judgment, or your preconceived notions of things away, and just be open. So if you can do that, I think that's a great start. Practically speaking, if you can taste things both on their own and with food, because I think some things are naturally, like from the whole wine thing, I get this all the time from like producers from, let's say, Italy or Greece, or like, why don't our wines get like 99 points and all like French wines? Our wines are beautiful food wines, and they're meant to be enjoyed with a meal. You have to have them with a meal in a context. And we're like, you know, everyone's tasting in these, you know, blind tasting clinical kind of atmospheres like ours. So it's important to taste it in that atmosphere, and then in the context of like a real meal or real social thing, and see how the experience changes for you. That will show you if that's a great product, because a great product mm-hmm. will show well in both environments. Personally, as far as like what you can do is make sure that open mind and a clean palate. Make sure you haven't had like, you know, a lot of, you haven't, if you can avoid smoking, that would be great. If you can avoid having a lot of, you know, sweet foods or spicy foods, and like kind of come at it like fully washed out, so there's nothing else that's biasing kind of your palate. Yeah.
I always avoid coffee the morning of tasting.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is tough.
Yeah.
But
it is tough. And you need something caffeine-oriented afterwards, usually, after a tasting.
Yes, sure. Yeah.
But before, it's kind of it's not a good thing. Coffee and cigarettes are terrible for tasting because it really skews.
Is it one of those things it's good to do actually in the earlier the better, in a sense, because your palate is just fresher?
We taste in the morning, most predominantly in the morning. We've done trials over years, and that's when you're most receptive to both your sense memories and your sensing ability, mm-hmm. you know, is then.
Yeah, I do like, I do go through the same process for every beer that I taste when I'm, you know, when I'm judging. So, you know, I just try to keep it consistent.
Sure, like so a baseball, that, like you're going, or golf swing, same time, every time.
Yeah, so, you know, mm-hmm. and I have my own little thing. I don't know, you know, I think I learned it through the BJCP program, but you know, I'm sure there's other ways to do it, but I the first thing I do is hold it up and try to evaluate the color, mm-hmm. you know, the cloudiness, although no one seems to care about that anymore.
Check.
The glitter, the foam on the, now the it's, you know, pink foam.
Now
the,
it's, oh, this isn't cloudy enough. Deducting a point. but, you know, I do that first, and then I try to rile up the foam, and I'll evaluate the carbonation level, and the color of the foam means mm-hmm. something to me. That kind of spells something's about the malt to me.
Sure.
And then I smell, and, you know, I'll smell it a few times, and all of this before I ever take a taste. Mm-hmm. And then I take a taste. I try to get my very first impressions and write down, you know, just one or two key words for my mm-hmm. very first impression. And then I go for that second taste and try to pull out nuances and all that. So that's okay. I try to do that for every single beer, you know, exactly the same way. So they're all, you know, it's just all done, you know, consistently.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's so ingrained in my process that I didn't think that I do it the same way too, but I do the exact same thing.
Yep.
And I was going to comment that you really can get the majority of the information before you even taste it. Mm-hmm. Like I can look at a beer and tell you it's going to be infected, maybe have different faults to it just by the color, the carbonation, and the way it swirls around in the glass. Hmm. And then combined with the smell, then you can tell exactly what you're going to get.
Yes. The last time I did the off flavor kit, I didn't have to taste anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I could pull them all out from the smell.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was, I think we, you know, scientists still debate.
Thank God, too, because tasting it is terrible.
Yeah, know, right? It's a chemical one.
It's hard to get some of those out of your mouth.
The caprylic stuff. Yeah, it's gnarly.
But the I think we taste six things, although they're always adding and subtracting.
Yeah,
what
sure.
We can taste.
The primary taste.
Yeah, right. And then but we can smell like 10,000. So it makes total sense that. You know, the smell sense is super important. So.
Yeah, and that's really the part of your taste that they're trying to finally figure out. There are all the theories about how you actually do smell and do taste. They're still working it out. The science is not in completely on all
It's
of
like
that.
Brain science, I mean, right? It's all being processed in our brain.
But the one thing is that it is mostly based on the aromas. The aromas are kind of guiding all those flavors combined with those primary tastes and creating this illusion in your head or this memory in your head of what it actually tastes like.
I have a funny story about Pilsner or Kel, of course. I was told because, you know, when I go over there, they're going to put me in the cellar and with the old men drinking the beer.
Yes.
And they're like, look, you know, we know you're a beer judge. Don't swirl that beer and don't smell it or you will get a slap in the head. I was like, why? And they're like, that's not how they like to drink it. You just got to put it right in your mouth hole and suck that stuff down.
Yeah.
And if they find you swirling it around and sniffing it, they're going to get pissed.
Don't even look at it.
Yeah. So now, the old men don't like pretentious beer judges coming in there and swirling and sniffing their beer. Like, drink that.
Yeah.
They need that in a Super Bowl ad. You know, then they'll hitting on all those.
Well, there's a reason. There's a reason it's the highest consumption per capita of any country. They're not wasting any time.
Yeah, right.
Any of that nonsense. It's going down, buddy.
This is true.
That's right. Oh, man. Yeah. I think I'm trying to think of resources, too. Like, I always liked, is it Randy Mosher's Tasting Beer? Is that right?
Yeah. Great book. Yeah.
It's a really good book,
And then, for resources for people, BJCP. Obviously, tasting.com. You have resources on there.
We do. We have resources about freshness, about all flavors and things like that, too.
Yeah.
So, and, of course, the Cicerone program, which
is Cicerone.
You guys are doing a great job.
Also, you know, totally based in the world of wine, right? I mean, I think Ray pretty much said we need a beer sommelier program, right?
Right. Exactly, to be on parity with the wine world, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And also based here in Chicago.
Yeah, I was going to say Chicago's actually with Siebel and you guys and Cicerone like punching above its weight. I mean, and it's got a big weight. We got a big weight here.
Yeah, well, the scene's finally caught up with it all too.
Yeah, right.
Because you know, for years we were not the beer city we are now.
Right. It's tied into the culinary scene. It's tied into, the fact that it's a destination, a cultural destination. Yeah, beer's part of the culture.
We might be the best food city in the country right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not traveling around comparing things, but it is the food is out of this world in Chicago at the moment.
Mm-hmm. We're very lucky.
We are. Yeah. All right. Well, it is shameless plug time.
All right.
I think. And, of course, we will start with our guest, Gerald. What would you like to tell the listeners about BTI and what's going on?
Well, I'd like just people to come to visit our site, tastings.com. What we do is every 15 days, we update the homepage with our latest reviews. So there's always fresh content. There's fresh recommendations. If you want to take the time, there's whole sections which you can learn about. We have a thing we just launched called Drinkopedia, which I'm constantly adding to. So
nice.
It's like we're really shooting to educate people about what they're drinking. Our motto is discover drinks you love. So it's not just, you know, the rating and all that, but we really want people to be better educated and know more about these categories and how to appreciate them.
That's a great name. I love that, Drinkopedia.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
All right, what's going on with the tours? We had a great one on Saturday at Patty Long's.
Thanks
always
for having
nice
us
crowd.
In. Yeah. It's been for as cold as it's been a good busy spring, and we're getting a lot of people, whether ranging from parent. One of my favorite groups of people is the parents with the adult children, because it's like, you know, you're 21, 22, your 20s, you're finally able to have a beer with mom and dad, you know, and the parents are always real cool. The parents that come on the tour, you know, it self-selects, but
that sounds great.
But it's a real fun adventure. But you know, we have so many different groups, so it's a lot of fun. How about you?
This weather has not been good for business for me. And I think for all of Chicago, I think, in fact, my business partner, Chris, was quoted in a Cranes article on Monday about how, although they talked to him a couple of weeks ago, and he was like, no, it's not affecting our business. But it is now, you know, last 2 weeks have been terrible. And that's going around. So any day the weather is going to break and this city is going to fucking explode.
Oh, it's going to be one of those.
People are just going to be let loose.
People are going to go apeshit.
It's going to be one of those years. Yep.
I can't wait. Yep. We are installing heaters in the beer garden right now.
All right. Good.
So hopefully the beer garden will be rocking, you know, May, no matter what the weather is. We got our new roof.
Sweet.
So, and then music is starting out there in May and, you know, our good friend Tommy Gerlach will be out
there. Yeah, that's so great to hear.
Love that guy. He's awesome. And what else is going on? I think I gave the Unfiltered Pilsner Kell dates in the last one.
Oh, cool.
That's coming. And
count me in for that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This Friday we have KBS and CBS from Founders at Kaiser and a bacon tasting with Pollyanna Brewery over at Patty's. So always something going on.
Nice.
Check the website. And remember, if you are listening on iTunes, please leave us a review as long as it's a good one.
Yep.
If it's a bad one, go leave us a review on Untappd. Yeah.
Self-delete.
Or Yelp. You can Yelp us. I'll be sure not to read that. All right. And again, thanks to everyone for listening. Yeah. Tell your friends, beeropinions.co.co. And that's it, Bruce.
That's it. Thank you so much. Thanks for being on. And
thanks, Joe.
Yeah, my pleasure, guys.
And rock and roll.
Cheers.